The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not necessarily reflect those of WREK Atlanta or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did. Oh,
well. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. Today's title is Separations, the Forgotten Science, where we'll look at a very important area of chemical engineering, but probably the scourge of all the chemical engineering students here at Georgia Tech. So if you're a chemical engineering student, later in the show, by all means, give us a call if you're listening live Wednesdays noon to 1 at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. Of course, if you just got an interesting question about the application of this underappreciated but very important area of applied science, separations, feel free to give us a call as well. Today, our guest is Ryan Lively, who just joined the Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering faculty just this year.
That's correct.
Right? After having done all three of his degrees, bachelor's, master's, and PhD at the Georgia Institute of Technology in chemical engineering, and spent approximately 3 years working for Elginal Biofuels. So what exactly did you do at Elginal?
Really, I worked on designing separation systems for recovering ethanol, which is the biofuel, from the raw feedstock of the biofuel plant, which was an algae-based plant.
Mm-hmm. And what is the feedstock that they use?
The feedstock is a cyanobacteria, and unlike other algae-based biofuel processes, they don't harvest the algae and grind them to make bio-oil or biodiesel. Mm-hmm. These cyanobacteria are special. They create ethanol and then secrete it through their cell walls. And then we have a broth that the algae are grown in, and we recover the ethanol from that broth.
Okay, so in a sense, it's a non-destructive
right
approach to this right sort of thing. And if you look at Elginal's website, I mean, this is touted as the future of biofuels.
That's at least what our marketing team says.
Okay. And they actually got a pretty cool cartoon.
It is pretty neat.
I like it there. And one of the most important things in it is the ability to separate these things out.
That is one of the more difficult challenges with this process, is the raw feed has an ethanol concentration of about 1%, mm-hmm, sometimes less. And for it to be biofuel grade that we can put into gasoline, mm-hmm, it needs to be 99.7%.
Right.
So there are a multitude of other components, primarily water, and we need to recover the ethanol out of that stream. And we don't want to simply boil that whole stream, because that's a major energy consumer.
Right, right. And this whole idea of boiling things and letting the more volatile things sort of boil off first, which is basically how we make moonshine, right?
That's exactly
right. The alcohol
sort
of comes off. You know, if you're making moonshine, well, that's a pretty high value-added product if you're making, you know, a really good bourbon or something like that.
Right.
So you could make your money back. We can do that with oil, right? Because we use the heavier parts, the oil for machine oil. We even use the bottom parts. That's what turns into asphalt. And people think of asphalt as a really bad product, but in fact, it is the single most recycled product in the world.
Right.
Nobody ever throws asphalt away. They add a little tar to it and
re-coat
your neighbor's street. And then the more volatile components, the kerosene, the gasoline, things like that, you get gases out of it as well. That's how we separate these things. But later in the show, we'll talk about some more energy efficient ways
right
to overcome that. And that's a huge amount of energy. And of course, you work in a number of different fields, right? So your research interests include that energy efficient separation process for everything from non-conventional natural gas recovery to ethanol recovery from these aqueous streams.
Right.
And that's the challenge, right? If it were 50% ethanol and you wanted to make it 90%, that's not too tough.
That's not too tough.
But, you know, 1% or a fraction thereof is pretty tough. Of course, you're also interested in rational design of multi-layer hollow fiber devices. Those are examples of some of these fancier, more energy efficient things
right
that we can talk about a little bit later. And literally creation and engineering of some of the polymeric materials that go into this sort of thing.
Right.
Right. Then, of course, you're also interested in some inorganic things. I'm looking at zeolites,
carbons,
right,
and then others.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And there's a big trade-off there. We like polymers because you can make them into the shape
that you want
very easily, but they don't always have the greatest properties compared to the inorganics.
Exactly.
And the problem is, if you've ever gone back and looked at a piece of plastic, whatever it is, it could be a consumer product, could be a plastic bag that you left in your garage for 20 years, and you pull it apart, it's brittle, it's changed its properties, polymers tend to flow a little. So all those are interesting things that your research addresses. But speaking of separating tiny bits of something in a particular stream, that's actually relevant to a portion of the program we often start with.
Science in the News.
And today's Science in the News comes from Chemical and Engineering News, the September 16th issue. This is something chemical engineers and chemists read on a regular basis. You know, it's not Vanity Fair, it's not People Magazine, but it actually has some really interesting stuff that's relevant to your everyday life. And there's a great article in this particular issue by Andrea Widener called Helium Headache. And it has to do with the fact that in 1996, Congress passed the, let's see what it's called here, the Helium Privatization Act, in which they basically said all this helium reserve that we're generating out in Texas by extracting helium from the natural gas fields there is no longer quite as important as we used to think it was. Many, many decades ago, we thought, look, this is a gas of strategic importance. And the importance is that we're going to do everything with blimps. Blimps were really big back then. And then we realized, okay, maybe blimps are not the right way to go. We preferred helium because everyone saw the Hindenburg blow up. So hydrogen, maybe not so good. And then over the years, Congress thought, well, this facility accrued a $1.3 billion debt. And they signed this act to get the Bureau of Land Management, which manages this facility, to sell it off and pay off that debt. And that makes sense. That's good fiscal management. Believe it or not, it was scheduled to be paid off in 2015. It's probably going to be paid off sometime at the end of this year. And this is the sort of thing that can generate between $150 and $200 million a year, because now helium is important for a totally different reason. And no, we're not talking about Macy's Day Parade balloons, and we're not talking about balloons for your kid's birthday party. I mean, originally it had some weird applications in X-ray scattering because it has a low cross-section. But the most common application of it now is nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, very important in a variety of fields. And most importantly, its medical application, magnetic resonance imaging. So to have these things available is very, very important. In fact, the article starts out by pointing out that Dean Olson, who started planning for the worst as a result of this, and by the way, the beginning of October is when this thing's going to be shut down. He's deciding whether or not to shut down several of the 11 nuclear magnetic resonance machines he oversees at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign to preserve the precious helium that cools the instrument's powerful magnets. The cause of Olson's dilemma, and that of hundreds of thousands of other people that use helium for this and other applications, is the uncertainty surrounding the future of the Federal Helium Reserve. So it's all stored in a geological formation called the Bush Dome Reservoir just outside Amarillo, Texas. It's strategically located near many helium-rich gas fields. By the way, it's a very, very small component of these natural gas fields. So we produce a lot of natural gas, and that's where it's extracted. But the House of Representatives has already passed some bills. Neither one, the Senate or the House bills, have actually passed in the other House to get them to strategically turn this sort of thing over. And a lot of companies, like now you're telling me it's Linde Gas Services?
Linde Gas.
Which depend on this, thought that it was going to be fine because the refiners and the people that store things there have a clause in their storage contract that they thought would avoid just this type of problem by allowing the industry to pay to continue running the Federal Helium Reserve. So they could actually go take it over from the Bureau of Land Management. It's perfectly lucrative. People make a lot of money off of this sort of thing. And then they could supply helium to everyone from your medical center that uses it for MRI to these big national and academic magnet labs that use it for all sorts of experiments. But the Bureau of Land Management says that the federal law takes precedence over any clause in the company's contracts, and they're just ready to shut it down. So it appears to be a bit of a snafu. And privatizing it, actually not a bad idea, right? Because this is a valuable commodity. We should give it over to a company at a reasonable price as long as they agree under regulation to make sure that federal government projects that need this have access to it. It actually represents 30% of the helium reserves on the planet. So this will be a big income, or this will have a big impact, rather. So we're hoping that the federal government, in the last few moments before the beginning of October, when this change is over, will pull their heads out of their high knees and maybe do this in a reasonable fashion. And again, privatization, a lot of liberal hippie college professors like me think that's a bad word. That may not be a bad word. I think that's perfectly fine, but do it in a fashion so that we don't disrupt this very important gas that's used for things other than balloons and the Macy's Day Parade.
Right. A lot of the upstream energy companies will actively seek out wells with high helium content because the small percent of helium in the well, which usually maximum 5%, is actually the most valuable thing in there, more so than all the hydrocarbons, the gas, and whatnot.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So helium wells are very valuable.
Right, and in particular, it's going up now because of the demand for all these magnets. And there's a reason why helium is such a touchy thing.
Right.
Why is that?
So helium is essentially one of the lightest gases, and in the atmosphere, it has a concentration of about 5 ppm, which makes it exceedingly difficult to recover out of the atmosphere. The problem is whenever you undo your helium balloon, it flies across the room. That helium, when it's vented, essentially has an escape velocity, and it can race to the outer exosphere of the atmosphere.
Right. So it's so small, and it has the same kinetic energy as the molecules around it because the temperature is equilibrated, which means to have that kinetic energy with the lower mass, it's got to have a higher velocity.
Right. Exactly.
You know, things like hydrogen, you know, must be escaping as well. But we don't worry about hydrogen.
We don't worry about
it. Because we've got tons of it. So that's why helium is actually extremely important, that we're eventually going to lose it when it gets put out in the atmosphere. Of course, I never just let the helium balloon go. I'm the guy that always inhales it and talks like the Austin's laughing. You guys, do they do that anymore? Do kids do that?
Yeah, all the time. I think it's not advised, but...
Well, it's ironic that the name of the article is helium headache. That's exactly what you get if you do too much of it.
Yeah.
Any inert gas, you're going to get a headache.
The new cool one to do that I'm going to do in my class is SF6, sulfur hexafluoride. So it's completely inert. Mm-hmm. If you inhale it, it is much more dense than air, unlike helium.
So it has the opposite change in density and modulus, so it sounds
lower. So you sound like
lower.
Barry White.
Oh, so...
Don't you have to go upside down afterwards? To let it escape because it does have lower gravity than air?
Well, you probably mix it with oxygen.
That would be one way to do it. I think your lungs can actually just exhale it naturally, but it takes much longer to... So one dose of SF6 lasts much longer than one dose of helium.
So sulfur hexafluoride, that's a very common molecule that you guys use because it's the big one.
It's a huge gas.
Yes.
There's a really famous demonstration. You can get a fish tank... Mm-hmm. And you can take a cylinder of SF6 with a hose, and you can fill the fish tank with SF6. It's an invisible gas. You can't see it. And you can take an aluminum foil boat, and if you're very careful, you can sit that boat on top of the SF6
and
in the fish
float.
Tank, and it'll float.
So I have to ask, because they did that on the Big Bang Theory. This is just a recent one.
The SF6.
Was it SF6?
That was SF6.
Because he claimed it wasn't. He claimed it was something else.
He said it was xenon, which I looked into. And xenon is actually an anesthetic. So you could do it, but then you would be really loopy.
Okay. But so what makes the sound lower is this combination of density and modulus. Does xenon have the properties to make your voice
Yeah, it
lower?
Does. It's also very dense.
Okay.
But
SF6 sounds horrible. Fluorine, sulfur. You're right. I've seen it in experiments. It is essentially inert.
It's really inert. It's actually very difficult to react with anything.
Right. And in fact, what you guys use it for is to sort of fine-tune these fibers that may represent one of the new ways to separate these things. And one of the interesting things is, when you boil stuff off on these distillation columns, and that takes a lot. How much energy do we spend on those kinds of separations?
And
I'm assuming you guys walk around with that figure in your back pocket.
Yeah, we have that one memorized. The best way to think about separations and their total energy uses and percentages, because the actual absolute numbers are so mind-boggling, they won't really mean anything. Separations as a whole use between 10 and 15% of all of the United States energy use. To put this in perspective, all of the commercial sector's energy use, which is heating, air conditioning, lighting, is about that same order of magnitude.
Okay.
So separations essentially are equivalent in energy consumption to the commercial sector, and they're about half the total energy consumed by the entire transportation fleet. So everybody's familiar with energy use in your car because it directly mm-hmm. affects you. You know, when the gas price goes up, you right. have to pay more, right. and you become more cognizant of how much energy you're using. Separations, the reason why we like to call them the lost science or the forgotten science, they're always behind plant boundaries. When you drive through Louisiana and Texas and you see these big plants, you're not really aware of how much energy is going into powering those columns. So they're out of the public sight, they're out of the right. public mind, but they're a huge energy consumer.
Right, and the one thing that we impress upon beginning chemical engineers is that if you're going to boil something, the biggest sink of energy is not heating it, but it's overcoming a phase change from liquid to gas, from mm-hmm. from solid to liquid. And in fact, that's why you don't fill your ice chest with cool water. You fill it with ice, because when that melts, you're really absorbing tons and tons of energy. Mm-hmm. Most of these solar processes where you'll absorb something out of salt, you'll go from solid to liquid. Your right. air conditioning, you'll try to get your coolant to change phase because you can store and manage tons of energy.
Right.
So imagine boiling all the oil we dig out of the ground.
That's
a lot of energy.
Right.
Right.
And just to sort of highlight how much separations touches our everyday life, I mean, a separation process is involved in almost everything you use. The obvious ones we talked about: automobile fuels, oils, lubricants. There's natural gas for heating your home, propane, liquid propane. Pretty much any plastic you use came from a chemical engineering process that had a major separation unit right. in it. Food and beverage is a huge separations area.
Mm-hmm.
Paper. Really, it touches every aspect of our life.
Right. So why aren't people aware of that? We don't have a good branding.
They're just hiding in plain sight. You know, the companies keep their flow sheets private. They may list their overall energy use if they're especially mm-hmm. Public, but typically that is not a number that's published.
Right, and I think about another obvious application: pharmaceuticals. Right,
that's another huge one.
When you make a pharmaceutical, you need to separate these things out, right? And that's a very time-consuming process. But even more importantly, many pharmaceuticals come from nature. But the problem is they're in such low concentration, kind of like this low concentration of ethanol problem you mentioned at the beginning of the program, that, you know, you debate whether it's more economically feasible to synthesize it, which may be very expensive, or just separate it from the, you know, fraction of a percent
right.
it is in a mineral or a root or the bark of a tree or something.
Right,
like
exactly.
That. Yeah.
And that's always that's the sort of classic chemical engineering trade-off. Should mm-hmm. we work on making our own version of this or purify right. a natural source?
Right. Yeah. Right. And I think of Taxol, the anti-tumor drug, which is this multi-step synthesis, very hard to make. But you find it in the bark of the yew tree. But the point is, we would spend, you know, billions of kilojoules of energy to separate this, and we would mow down entire fields
right.
of these trees. So that's kind of the trade-off that you make when you think about separations. So in general, what are the different ways that we
sure.
do separations? How do separations work? We talked about this different boiling point approach, but there are others.
Right. So I would say since man first figured out how to make booze, we have been in what I call the thermal age of separations.
Okay.
And essentially it involves heating whatever we're trying to separate or cooling whatever we're trying to separate and waiting for a phase change to happen. So the obvious one we've talked about is distillation, which is based off the relative volatility of whatever you're trying to separate.
Right.
So ethanol and water is always a classic one. Ethanol is more volatile than water. So if we heat the whole mixture up,
mm-hmm.
The ethanol vapor above that liquid mixture will be enriched in ethanol.
Right.
There's less obvious ones. Crystallization is a very common one. And crystallization is essentially you cool a liquid mixture of components down, and one of the components will crystallize or form a solid before the other components. The best example here is when you make rock candy at home.
Right.
You have sugar and water, you heat it up, and then when you cool it back down,
yeah.
sugar crystallizes.
And all these kids that buy the nice little crystal kits, my son had one of these, they're all, you heat it up, you super saturate it, and then you let it cool, and it comes on out. Yeah.
So a lot of the plastic precursors are separated and purified using crystallization. Another big one is evaporation. This is where you just essentially remove all the liquid to leave a solid behind. Best example here is if you have a pile of wet towels and you hang them out to dry, the water evaporates, you get dry towels.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple.
So one would think salt production.
Salt
production. Because they do it in ponds, it's exactly how they're doing
it.
Yeah. Okay.
And salt production is essentially timeless. You know, we've been doing that
right
forever. And then the last one is solvents. So if you've ever been near a swamp or near an actual natural gas well, you always smell this really bittersweet, sour smell, and that's hydrogen sulfide, H2S. Mm-hmm. People call this sour natural gas, and obviously nobody wants to burn sour natural gas in their homes or at their offices.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, you can't put that into our natural gas pipeline network because it would rust and destroy the network. So they remove the H2S and a lot of times the CO2 and the natural gas. And the way they do that is they take that gas mixture and they contact it with a solvent. And the solvent will essentially dissolve CO2 and H2S. And then you have clean natural gas, which you can use. Where the thermal part comes in is you don't want to just throw that solvent out. You need to regenerate it so you can keep using it. So you have to heat all of that solvent back up to undissolve the hydrogen sulfide and the CO2.
Right. And the classic example is, people often put in their ads funny glassware. And it's usually not the glassware that's relevant to the product they're talking about. But if you ever see that funny tear-shaped glass thing with a little stopcock on the bottom, that's the laboratory scale of what you're talking about. We call it a separatory funnel, where you put two things in there, you shake it, it goes into one of the liquids, you open the stopcock, get the heavier liquid out, and that's what you're doing.
That's exactly
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So solvents can be used for liquid phase separations as well as gas phase.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So those are sort of the big four thermal approaches: distillation, crystallization, evaporation, and solvents.
But now there's something new on the horizon.
Right. So now the idea is we don't want to heat up the entire mixture, or we don't want to cool down the entire mixture.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of these, well, wouldn't it be nice if I could, with a pair of molecular tweezers, grab one of the components and not the other.
Right. And the point you're making is that whether it's directly as in distillation, the thermal age that started with booze, that's an interesting way to think about it, but I think you're absolutely right. Or, liquid-liquid extraction with solvents or evaporization or crystallization, there's usually some heating step that requires a lot of energy.
That's where the energy is used, in the heating or cooling step.
Yeah.
So the two most promising energy efficient approaches are to worry about the species affinity for a surface, which we'll go into in a second, and the size of the species. So everything you're trying to separate has some size.
Mm-hmm.
So molecules have a certain size and they're not all the same. They're all different. So one of these approaches, which is called adsorption with adsorption, which causes great consternation in chemical engineering.
Right. Yeah. So for our chemical engineering novices out there, it takes our students a while to get this. So when you say it with a D, adsorption, as Ryan just mentioned, that means whatever is being, going to the surface of these things is only going to the surface, right? And it's within, does it get in the nooks and crannies? We're not going to argue about, but it's within a few nanometers of the surface. It goes on the surface and it doesn't burrow, micrometers, millimeters, centimeters into the material like a sponge. That's absorption with a B. Right.
Right. And typically chemical engineers like to simplify things, so we often just call it sorption, which is the easy way to do it.
Great.
So the best example that you might have experienced in day-to-day for adsorption is if you have a really funky smell in your fridge and maybe your great-grandmother said put a bowl of baking soda in the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
That baking soda essentially will adsorb the odor molecules that are in the atmosphere of the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
So those odor molecules will land on the surface of the baking soda powder, and they're removed from the gas phase, and you no longer smell them. Eventually, the baking soda will be full of the odor molecules.
Right. You've coated every bit of surface of every bit of particle in it.
Right.
Yeah.
So one of the energy-efficient ways to do these separations we're talking about is to design these surfaces and make sure we have enormous surface areas within each powder particle. So that way we can remove a lot of gas with this powder.
Right.
And then we want to make them selective.
Right, for a particular thing you want to separate.
Exactly.
Okay.
So a lot of these materials we make, these are inorganic materials. They're porous, and they're crystals. So it's a crystal like salt is a crystal, but there are pores running through the crystal. And that those pores create surface area for adsorption to occur. And a lot of these materials have enormous surface area. It's almost unbelievable. Mm-hmm. One material we make, if we have a gram of it, if we unrolled that gram surface area and made it flat and put on a football field, it would go from the end of the end zone to the 40-yard line in 1 gram of that material.
Okay, so almost half a football field for a fraction of a teaspoon is what we're talking
about.
Right.
So it's truly mind-boggling trying to imagine how much area is are inside these crystals. And so if we can make that area selective for, in the natural gas example, CO2 or H2S over the natural gas, then we can get rid of these big solvent systems.
Okay. So let's take a quick break here, but when we come back, let's talk about some of the advanced science that goes into making these high surface area and very selective materials.
Sure.
And once again, let me remind any of our listeners that are listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to one, that if you've got a question or comment about modern separation materials or applications thereof, by all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Need something to get your mind moving? Listen to Psych Out every Wednesday evening from 11 to midnight on 91.1 FM. We'll help you get there. That's Psych Out, bringing you an hour of potent psychedelia every Wednesday from 11 p.m. to midnight, here on your home for quality diverse programming, WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Here on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM, we fill our weekend with diverse music from all over. Blues, reggae, jazz, classical, folk, world, and plenty of music that's simply unclassifiable. Tune in to the Weekend Cornucopia on Saturday and Sunday to hear quality, diverse music that you don't hear on the radio.
This Thursday on WREK Atlanta Tech Talk, the most revered talk show in the land.
Everything and
nothing.
Which includes weather and traffic.
It's gonna rain knowledge. All the roads is closed.
Tech issues.
You gonna learn something today, boy.
Memes.
Why you know like Tech Talk?
Calculus equations.
Delta Epsilon proof.
Do it! Relationships.
What is that about?
News.
What's going on?
Tech Talk. Every Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. on WREK Atlanta Zone, 91.1 The Laser.
Pew, pew, pew!
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Ryan Lively from the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering about the lost science or the forgotten science of separations. And before the break, we were starting to talk about some of the new high-tech materials for adsorption. And during the break, you pointed out that they like to use sorption because it's hard for people to imagine that you unroll a gram of something. When we say unroll it, we unroll it at a molecular level. So the crystals aren't just the things that have a surface area. They have all sorts of little holes and channels and pores, and these things are tiny. They're of the size of a molecule, slightly bigger. They have to be a little bit bigger so they can diffuse in there. And if they completely coat these scaffolds inside there, then you can imagine a huge amount of surface area.
Right. That's exactly correct.
Right. So examples of this sort of thing.
So the baking soda example is a good one, but the surface area in baking soda is fairly low.
Yeah, because it's only the outside of the crystal.
It's really the only the outside. Some very common examples you probably have sitting around the house are your Brita water filters.
Right.
Those essentially are either activated carbon or ion exchange resins. It depends on the company. But for the carbon case, it's essentially just a carbon powder. It's made from burning typically coconuts for whatever reason. And the water is pumped through a bed of this carbon, of this essentially old charcoal.
Yeah.
And there are pores in there, and those pores will selectively grab any big contaminants in the tap water. So by the time the water's progressed through that bed and made it to the outlet where you have your cup of water, essentially have had all the contaminants removed and they're stuck inside the filter.
So is that more of a size or a chemical affinity kind of thing?
That one's more of an affinity approach. There are size ones, but not in everyday use. Those are all at plants typically.
Okay. And if you think about it, if I think about carbon relative to water, right, and we use it for the filtration of water, believe it or not, if you get some sort of toxin in your system and you go into an emergency room, we think about pumping your stomach. They don't actually put a tube down your throat and pump the contents up. What they do is they take a slurry of this, a form of this activated carbon, and it's horrible black-looking stuff, squirt it down your stomach, and then they pump that out.
Right.
But if you think about it, most of the things that I wouldn't want in my stomach would be all the things that aren't like water.
Right.
And carbon likes carbony things, not water, so any toxin point, for example, an alcohol would be more likely to go to the carbon than the water, so you'll selectively pull
the alcohol
out.
Exactly right.
Yeah, and that actually makes a good point, that when it comes to separations, it's really not how much of it absorbs, it's how much it absorbs relative to the other thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So it'll take the organic contaminant out. And then if it doesn't, you know, if it's only two times as much or four times or ten times is a good target to get, you can't maybe do it all in one stage, but you do the stages over and over
until
again.
Until it's at what purity you want.
Yeah,
and we call that number we call selectivity. So separation processes always have a selectivity. And one of the reasons why the thermal processes we talked about before are so entrenched is they have enormous selectivities, very good selectivities. So there's a lot of experience and essential general comfort with these thermal approaches that some of the new advanced approaches have to overcome that barrier and have to demonstrate selectivities comparable to the thermal selectivities.
And this must involve a lot of really advanced chemistry, because if you're trying to select one over the other, and you're selecting it to two molecules that are similar size or have similar structure, meaning they like water, they don't like water, if it's similar, it's really hard to get a difference in there. And I guess maybe the most practical application of bumping into that selectivity barrier is when you know, for any college students, and I don't want to encourage this, of course, you go out and buy, you know, some brand of grain alcohol, and it's like, what, around 98% or so, and that has to do with the fact that at that concentration, the selectivity between the vapor and the liquid phase of alcohol and water is identical.
Right.
So when you boil it at that point, the vapor and the liquid are the same. You can no longer separate it.
Right.
And that's why you're limited to 98%, which, by the way, is more than you should ever mix into a drink. And for those students that think, well, I'll go by the 99.999% reagent grade stuff, you don't want to do that, because the way they get around that is usually by adding a third chemical. And the third chemical changes the volatility, so you can get better than that. But the third chemical is usually benzene or a derivative of one of these class 1 carcinogens.
Right. Bad idea.
Yeah. So, but as we illustrated, that maybe the state isn't always that smart about these things. The state still puts a tax liquor stamp on that 99.999% alcohol, which you should never drink. But they're like, hey, they're pulling a fast one. We don't want to avoid the taxes.
Right.
So they'll still tax it. But if you guys are planning a fraternity party or anything like that, avoid that.
Definitely.
So.
Or a band party.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have pretty good parties, I've heard.
The band?
The band does,
so I was
actually
in the band, and they label us band guys geeks, but were you saying a Georgia Tech, the band guys party?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Yeah, we'll have to ask Cliff Henderson about this, one of your colleagues.
That's
that was
right.
In the band.
Yeah. So for adsorption, we can go back to that.
Yes, let's get back to serious stuff
right
here. I'm done making inappropriate jokes for the time being.
There's two approaches you can do for adsorption. One is designing the surface of the adsorbent so it will selectively grab one species over another. The other way is you can put a gate or a portal into the adsorbent that is bigger than one species but smaller than the other. So if I have A and B, and A is very small and B is very big, and I have the portal size right in between those two, and I feed that mixture to my adsorbent, A can go in and B is rejected. And there's no heat use at all associated with this process, simply just mechanical driving force.
Right, right.
Right. So those are the two approaches. One is a molecular sieving, like, you know, a sieve that you're used to, and the other is a chemical approach. So a good example of the chemical approach is we can put groups on the surface that are basic. And you know from chemistry 101, you never mix acids and bases. Well, if we feed a acid gas like CO2 or H2S to this adsorbent that has basic groups, the acid gases will strongly interact with those basic groups, and we have a clean product on the other end.
Okay, so that would be used for CO2 absorption.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, CO2 absorption, we think of it as an acid, but most, you know, of our listeners think of, you know, sulfuric and nitric acid,
right,
the strong mineral acids. But you throw CO2 in water, and it's basically carbonic acid
exactly
in that form. So
yeah, okay. Coca-Cola.
Okay,
right.
There you go. Yeah, and if you've ever done that experiment, there's the carbonic acid. There's also some phosphoric acid in
That's
there
right
as well. Almost anything dissolves in Coca-Cola.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wonder if it works for Mountain Dew. Probably not.
Okay. Yeah, because I don't think it quite has the phosphoric acid.
Right. I don't. Yeah.
And are you a Mountain Dew caffeine junkie? Is that your?
Yeah, I'm more of a Red Bull guy, but
okay.
I am in fact drinking a soda right now.
No, that's okay. I had a Code Red Mountain Dew on the way in. I do occasionally drink Red Bull. Red Bull, dangerous stuff though. It's
well, I limit it to one a day.
That's, okay, yeah. I would agree with that. You go more than one a day, you have problems.
I agree.
Okay.
So we're not technically allowed to talk about Mountain Dew, I think, because this is a.
This is Atlanta.
This is
Atlanta. Coke country.
Right,
right,
exactly. So another approach to energy efficiency that's not adsorption is one I think you know about, is membranes. So a membrane is essentially in its simplest, is a polymer film that separates a high-pressure gas from a low-pressure gas. And a good example of this is a balloon. If you fill up a balloon with air and it's, you know, nice and inflated, and you come back, you know, 2 or 3 days later, the balloon is mostly deflated. That's because the air that is inside the balloon as a result of the pressure diffused through that polymer film.
Right.
And
right
left. So the oxygen and nitrogen in air will diffuse at different rates. So if I put a helium, since we're talking about helium, a helium atmosphere outside of the balloon, the oxygen would diffuse through the rubber of the balloon faster than the nitrogen would. So the interior of the balloon would be enriched in nitrogen.
Right.
So the fact that those two species permeate at different rates is a separation.
Right. But in fact, if you put helium in the balloon,
right,
it diffuses out that much faster for the same reason that it escapes our
atmosphere. That's exactly right.
Right. And that's why hardly anyone puts helium in a regular latex balloon anymore. They're all the Mylar ones, which have a lower permeability.
Right. So essentially, depending on how you design the polymer, mm-hmm, you can control the permeability of different species through it.
Right.
And these polymers can have very high selectivities. You can get, for oxygen nitrogen, you can have oxygen permeate through 7 times faster than nitrogen. Mm-hmm. To completely replace distillation for making liquid nitrogen and liquid oxygen, mm-hmm, you need selectivities somewhere around 10, 11, 12.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the research in the area is developing membranes that have selectivities higher than 7. But the current state of the art is about 7.
Okay. But maybe that's not so bad, because if you think about it, if you really want to get pure oxygen and pure nitrogen, you're right, you'd need that high selectivity. But there are plenty of applications, and the one I can think of is on Caribbean islands for scuba divers like myself. We don't dive with pure oxygen, but we'd like to have a breathing gas that's a little enriched, mm-hmm, right? So instead of being 21%, it's 28%, 32%,
right,
such that when we go over the side of the boat, two things happen. One, you're less likely to succumb to the bad effects associated with nitrogen. They get absorbed in fatty tissues, you get the bends, you get this nitrogen narcosis issue. Also, I do find that, you know, if you were at a band party the night before, and, you know, dragging in the morning, a little bit of pure oxygen helps.
Wakes you up.
Yeah, you do one of these nitrox, you know, enriched gas dives.
I've heard of those.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And now I know why they do the oxygen bars.
Right.
And a lot of the salty dive masters, they'll take a hit off the boat's pure oxygen. I'm like, why are you doing that? And it's like Red Bull. It's not something you should do, because it increases your metabolism. It actually has a bad effect if you do too much of it.
Well, you reminded me of another interesting point when it comes to selectivity and membranes. Mm-hmm. You don't always need 99.99% O2.
Right.
So a really good example that most people are unaware of is on commercial airliners. There's actually a membrane unit currently installed, and that is, as the air is passing over the airplane, they strip out the oxygen and make a pure or near-pure nitrogen stream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what they do with that nitrogen stream is they blanket the fuel tanks on the plane with nitrogen.
Right.
And that's for fairly obvious reasons. We don't want there to be oxygen present above our fuel tanks.
Right. So even if there was a spark or ignition source, the idea of flammability limits, right, that if you're too lean in oxygen, you could light a lighter above this hydrocarbon thing, and it just literally would not go. And that was, I believe, in response to one of these airlines exploding over the Atlantic or something like that.
Yeah, so I think a 90s development.
Yeah, something like that.
So most planes have this system nowadays.
Right. So where are these things going? So we have some of these membranes. We can separate. We have these absorbents.
Sure.
Right. And by the way, these aren't all that fancy. So you mentioned molecular sieves, right, mm-hmm, for this sizing effect. You can buy molecular sieves in a big bag, and you can throw them in your solvent, and they will selectively absorb water.
Right.
And it's a good way to do that last fine-tuning of water out of things. And they're really not all that expensive. But you guys are doing some really interesting things with trying to make these things even better.
Right. So you can buy these molecular sieves. You can buy the polymers to make membranes, mm-hmm, or adsorbents. The problem is these are really only limited to small-scale use, like lab use or, you know, mm-hmm, around your house, you know, making pure water. What we're aiming for is to tackle these big separation problems, this 10 to 15% of all energy use in the U.S. We want to remove the thermal age and replace it with the molecular sieving age.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to do that is, you know, we can work on designing these new materials, but we need to figure out how to actually get these materials out into the field to really do these separations. And that's where there's been a big gap in the R&D arena. Is you have process engineers trying to design processes and materials engineers designing these new materials, but nobody's really sort of connecting the two. And And our approach is we can take these advanced materials and we can put them into fibers, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And these fibers, we can mass manufacture them, and they're like in advanced manufacturing jobs in the U.S. And the way they're produced is inspired by the synthetic fiber, textile fiber industry. And that industry over the whole world makes something like 400 trillion meters of fiber per year. So it's incredibly scalable. So what we can do is we can take our specialty adsorbents or our specialty polymers, and we can spin them into these fibers, and the fibers are hollow, and we can assemble them into like a shell and tube style device.
Right.
And it, for all the chemical engineering people out there, it looks like a heat exchanger, but with these tiny little fibers about the size of your hair.
Right, right.
And so we can feed the gas on one side, and we get product A on one side and product B on the other. So it is essentially going from materials discovery and engineering to making devices that we can actually put out in the field.
So how does one make a fiber hollow?
That's a very good question. So the way you would typically make a fiber is you have a die, which just has a hole in it, and we would extrude a polymer solution through that die, and we get a solid fiber. Well, what we can do is we can put another hole inside the hole, and so you have a needle sticking out of the hole in the die.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and that needle, we can extrude out a neutral solution, and the polymer solution still being extruded. And when we get done with the whole process, you wash out that neutral solution, and you're left with a hole in the middle.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so it all happens at steady state.
So if you think about it, though, if one of your goals, as you mentioned before, is to get really high surface area, it'd be really great to make these things very, very thin.
Exactly.
And if you think about, you know, sort of a die with a needle in it, that sounds kind of big, but then do you have a high take-up rate? You really pull on these things to make them even thinner?
Yeah, so we, you know, these are highly viscoelastic. It's like molasses, you know,
right,
you can
right.
Pull little threads out of molasses if you try. Well, we do the same thing. When the fiber comes out of the die, we put it on a drum, and the drum rotates at very high speeds. And within my lab, we can make these at about 50 meters per minute with one line.
Right.
And at industrial scales, you can have multiple lines running, and then each die can have five or six filaments coming out of it.
Right, right.
So in the in a unit the same size as the one I have in my lab, which is a small unit, if I did this parallel processing and multi-filament production, I can make over a kilometer per minute of fiber.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. So it's truly mass manufacturing of advanced materials.
Right. Right, but if you think about it, maybe it's a little more complicated than that, right? Because if you look at these fibers under a microscope, they're not just sort of this hollow thing. They have an interesting shape or morphology to this, right? Are a lot of these sort of skin-type things?
If we're going to make membranes, one thing that we have to control during the spinning process is we want the outer radius or the outer shell of the fiber to be perfectly dense and very thin. So we want it to be 100 to 200 nanometers thick.
Right, right.
That's what does the actual separation. That 100 to 200 nanometer thick layer is what separates A and B. But that layer is so thin, it wouldn't be able to support itself. So we need to have a nice, strong polymeric support underneath it. And this needs to be open, at like an open network pore structure. It looks like a sponge.
Right, right.
So we make that all happens at the exact same time in the spinning process. We make the 200 nanometer layer and the porous support in the same step.
Right. And if you think about it, this is actually a pretty common theme, right? Most of either the barrier or the separation part is a really thin layer, and then there's always a support. So
right.
I think one of our colleagues does, Mark Prausnitz, is he does a lot of work on skin permeability. And if you think about it, if you look at your skin, which is relatively thick, right? I mean, you have several microns of the relevant epidermis, but it's really the uppermost layer, the thinnest layer, the stratum corneum, that does all the barrier, and then the rest of it is really sort of support for these sorts
it's
of
very,
things.
It's very similar structure.
Yeah. But these hollow fiber things, I mean, they've been around for a while. You can buy them in a nice little tube module with, you know, dozens or hundreds of fibers going through them.
Right.
I could filter oxygen and nitrogen if I wanted to make my own oxygen-enriched dive gas.
So they're made at very small scales. And with what we'll nicely say are second generation polymers.
Mm-hmm.
So these polymers have certain selectivities, but they're certainly not the selectivities that we need.
Mm-hmm.
So this is back to the materials engineering. We need to focus on developing more advanced polymers and more advanced sorbents to get the selectivities into the fiber form. Now, one thing that we're doing that nobody else is doing is we can spin adsorbent fibers, which are a whole new class.
Ah, okay, because most of these fibers is that outer skin has a selectivity for permeability. So you can put you put air through it, and you can then...
You get oxygen on one side.
Oxygen on one side and a nitrogen-rich stream. And then if it's not pure enough for you, you run it through another module and another module. So you spin adsorbents.
Yeah, so what we can do is we can... In the polymer solution that is the precursor to spinning the fibers, we can disperse in large amounts of the adsorbent particles.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, we discovered that the little bit of polymer that you have to make up the actual guts of the fiber
mm-hmm.
are strong enough to support enormous amounts of adsorbent. So we can have fibers that we can tie in knots,
mm-hmm.
but they're really 70% crystals or 70% solids.
Oh, wow.
Which is was amazing. That was sort of completely mm-hmm. unexpected. So this opens up a whole new era of making mass manufacturing adsorbents rather than trying to make little adsorbent pellets, which is what we do now.
So essentially what you're doing is you're getting this hybrid thing that has the advantages of an organic polymer, meaning you can make it into a film or a fiber that's flexible and you can deploy them wherever you want.
Exactly.
Versus the reason these inorganic things, right? When we say inorganic, we usually mean involving some metal oxide. So something in the middle of the periodic table as opposed to organic, which is mainly carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, mm-hmm. oxygen in the upper right-hand corner that tends to make flexible polymers. All these inorganics, they form sort of rigid particles. They're crystalline. They can't bend. They can't turn into a sheet that you can roll and put somewhere or things like that. But you've got the best of both worlds. You suspend them in a polymer so mm-hmm. you can extrude them and make them really quick, use them in an easy fashion. But they have this very regular structure. That's the nice thing about inorganic salts is it's 99.999% of it is the exact same structure.
Exactly.
Polymers, so if you look at your soft drink bottle, they're sort of all over the place. They're this amorphous thing. That's mm-hmm. why they're clear. That's why we can see through them.
Right.
Wow. So there it is. It's a good example of sort of mixing two things.
That's exactly right. So we take the processability of the polymer and essentially the almost like molecular tweezers of the inorganic combine them.
So are there any interesting applications for these things? Like, for example, energy?
Yeah, so in the energy field, a lot of the major thrusts right now are removal of sour gas, H2S and CO2 mm-hmm. from natural gas. That's a huge one,
right?
Especially with offshore natural gas.
Right.
Another big one is recovery of what we call natural gas liquids. And these are the main valuable component in shale gas,
mm-hmm.
which we could probably do a whole show just on shale gas.
Yeah.
Another hot topic is removal of CO2 from power plants because there's a lot of indications that CO2 are responsible for global climate change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one solution out of a whole array of solutions is grabbing the CO2 from power plants and using it for something or sticking it somewhere not in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Another one we touched on was air separation. There's helium recovery, which is becoming more and more important.
Right.
And then finally, there's hydrogen separation. And hydrogen is a major precursor to ammonia fertilizers, which mm-hmm. is a huge process.
Right, right. So basically, nitrogen and hydrogen to make ammonia. Ammonia is what we make nitrate fertilizers mm-hmm. out of. The Haber process garnered the Nobel Prize because it changed the way we produce plants, mm-hmm. right? A lot of people were really hungry before that.
Exactly.
But now getting hydrogen for fertilizer, all sorts of other interesting synthetic things you can do with
it. The Haber process, we actually went over this in my introductory chemical engineering class today. I showed this plot of the world population as it really is and what the predictions of the world population were without the Haber process.
Right.
And it is a stark difference.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah. And you think, wow, I'm motivating this for my students on drastic changes in world population.
From a chemical engineer.
Yeah, and then they just don't get too excited about it. I think if it doesn't involve Justin Bieber or something like that, they're just not too excited. But you mentioned the unique thing about what you do is you do adsorbents, right? Mm-hmm. So if you do filtration with membranes, well, one thing goes on one side, one thing goes on another. You operate it continuously. But if it's an adsorbent, it absorbs, right? And then eventually you need to get that thing off of it. How do you do that?
So the best way to remove the adsorbed species, there's many ways you can do it. It depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to purify the species that adsorbed, you typically what you will do is you'll reduce the pressure of the system. Mm-hmm. And the affinity for a species for a surface is strongly pressure dependent. Mm-hmm. So if we drop the pressure of the system, the adsorbed species will come back out. And by very carefully controlling what is in the voids of the system, at what times, when we drop the pressure, we can make very pure products out of what was adsorbed.
Right.
If we don't want it, it's really easy. Just periodically, once every week, every day, or every month, and it doesn't really matter, we can just heat the bed up and you remove the trace component.
Okay. So and the thermal act sort of volatilizes that. Mm-hmm. Right. So basically, you're talking about pressure swing and thermal swing adsorption.
Right. Those are the two most common. Though there are other.
For your students that are listening who are going to see this.
Right.
At a later date.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are other ones which are more elaborate, but they always come down to temperature pressure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for putting this in perspective with regard to everyday examples. You could have very easily gone into the details of the chemistry and how you make this thing, affinities. And the chemistry is mind-boggling because we simulate some of these things. And
there's a lot of things happening at once.
Yeah, and particularly you think, well, I put a little solid in there, and of course it goes to the solid and does that, and I get good absorption. But then you realize the solid makes this big void area in the polymer around it, and you've got this big open space, and it kind of defeats the all sorts of nasty things that you deal with.
One of the fun parts about separations is we get to work with the traditional chemical engineering curriculum. We do a lot of thermo, a lot of mass transport, which some people run away from screaming in terror, but some of us actually like chemi.
Okay. So unique adsorbents and filtrations using things like hollow fibers may be the future of separations, the forgotten science, which began, I think, with booze. Right?
Yeah, it did begin with booze.
The thermal age, right?
Yeah.
And hopefully these new approaches will be more energy efficient at various applications than, say, distillation, crystallization, evaporation, and liquid-liquid extraction. Because even though liquid-liquid extraction, you mix two liquids, doesn't really require much energy, somehow you got to get the thing out of one of those liquids, possibly both, and you have to worry about that. But by applying chemistry in a very judicious way to fine-tune the size of the pores in these materials and the chemical affinity for something to absorb in these things. And by the way, the whole adsorption and permeation thing kind of go hand in hand because if something doesn't get absorbed on something, it's not going to go through it. So these are inextricably linked.
Exactly.
And I think that's what makes it complicated for a lot of the students as well. But hopefully this will help us overcome the use of 10 to 15% of all the U.S. energy for separations.
Right.
And the point you make is, well, we can do a lot of this stuff at the laboratory scale now, but if we want to do it on large-scale applications to truly impact the way we deal with energy and other applications, it's going to be much, much bigger and has to be maybe much more efficient in a particular way. And then, of course, the one thing we learned is that if you want to pull off the talk like Barry White, breathe the gas in thing that people may have seen on Big Bang Theory without falling asleep, right? Using an anesthetic, SF6, right? Hexafluorosulfide, is that what you'd call it? Would do that. And for those of you that, you know, the example you mentioned about hydrogen sulfide and are thinking, well, my natural gas smells bad anyway. Hydrogen sulfide, very corrosive, actually very toxic.
And very poisonous.
So they pull that out and they replace it with the tiniest bit of another sulfur compound, right? Some other simpler mercaptan.
That's harmless.
Right. That's harmless. And it's just there to let you know you have a gas leak.
Right. Methane, which is natural gas, has no smell of its own.
Right. So there it is. Separations, engineering your everyday life. Did we leave anything out?
I think that's it.
Okay. All right. So, Ryan, thank you so much for being on the program.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Yeah. And for those of you listening, if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. Our chief engineer is Austin Redd. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.